go down, take them down to the bottom line. We get to the end of the line, they'll take $238 million. If we do it now, we run the risk of being out. I said, well, we can't. I said, well, we'll ask them to take back paper and, you know, take back a note for whatever it was, 47 million, 34 million. I said, we can't do that. They said they don't want to take back paper. They're a big client of the banks. We can't do that. So Flaherty was chosen, went forward, and he gets to the closing, and he says, oh, by the way, he says, we can only finance 150 million. And so you have to take back a note. And of course, they wanted to close by the end of the year. That's what happens with big companies. And so they said, well, they extracted a slight pound of flesh, I'd say a pork chop maybe or something, because they raised the price to $300 million but took back $150. Flaherty, as I say, in a few years sold off the pieces, cleared a couple hundred million for himself, and went on to be one of the richest men around. Has a magnificent house in Palm Beach. Every time I go past it, I salivate. But so I had considered leaving to do what I subsequently decided to do, to answer your question. I had even considered leaving before that. And I was very close to leaving, and I remember I told them that I wanted to leave, and I forget whether it was to buy some assets we were selling or just why. And maybe it was just prior to this, I don't know, but Bob Anderson flew in, and we had breakfast at the Four Seasons, and Bob said to me, he said, look, I don't want you to leave. He said, I've got great plans for you, and he said, I want you to stay. And I said, oh, whatever I did say and indicated that I wanted to leave, he said, no, I'd like you to stay. He said, and, you know, let's put this behind us and forget about it. I want you on board. And so I agreed to stay, and as we were walking out of the restaurant, out of the Four Seasons, he put his arm on my shoulder, and he said, I'm glad you're staying. He said, but if you told me no and you were going to leave, I was going to tell you that I was going to back you and give you some money to invest for me. And I said, Bob, you told me that before I'd be leaving. So he had always wanted me to be president of the company. And as a matter of fact, one of his people told me one time when we were traveling together in Europe that he felt I was the most like him from an entrepreneurial standpoint. And we were at a meeting in Italy. He was an incredible man. He had called me and said, I'm going to Italy to the Aspen Institute. I meet a lot of important people there. You want to, with your operations in southern France, understand the Mediterranean basin and what's going on there, he said, because this is what the conference is about. And come up to dinner in New York, and then we'll leave from there and go to Venice to the meeting. And so there was an incident that happened there that was very interesting, because Barbara Anderson was there, his wife, and Ann was there. And so as we were getting ready to leave, Barbara and Ann were going back to Philadelphia, and she was visiting a daughter in Cherry Hill, and she said to Ann, do yourself a favor, don't let Bob make him like himself. She said, he should be going to see his new granddaughter in Cherry Hill, and he's going off to some conference in Venice. And he said, oh, Barbara, keep quiet, hell knows. Knows his priorities and so on and so forth. And so we took off and went to Italy. This meeting was incredible, because I think there were six prime ministers or former prime ministers there. I remember there was Dennis Healy, Pierre Trudeau. There were other people. Aga Khan was there, if you can believe that. And, so I sat as an observer. Bob chaired the meeting,
we landed and one of his consultants picked us up and took us by motor launch to the conference. And I just listened, and I remember there was a very spirited discussion between, I forget his name, but he was an at-large ambassador from the United States. And there were Arabs there and Israelis and so forth. And it was a useful meeting and great exposure. And I did get a better understanding of what was in store. You know, there are 100 million people in the Mediterranean basin, and growing very rapidly the population. And that's why he wanted me to be there. He really was interested in how a plan for us to exploit the Mediterranean basin. And that was one of his great strengths. He was a visionary. And as we were leaving, he said, look, I want to take you to meet the president of Italy, and I'm going to Rome tomorrow. And then he said, I have to fly on to China. He said, so you can catch a commercial plane for Rome. I said, sure. And so we went to Rome, and turned out the president of Italy just wanted to see Bob. He didn't want an entourage or any other people. And so he asked me if I would make sure he took about 8 or 10 people on the plane with him, that all these people got back to the United States and so forth. And it was an interesting time. I remember the head of the Aspen Institute was a man, I forget his name, but his mother was Diana Vreeland, who was the editor of what's that great women's magazine? But anyway, the editor of one of the large magazines, and he invited us all to his house for dinner. A couple of Moroccans and a woman from Brazil and myself and one of Bob's aides and consultants. And we went there, and his wife didn't realize we were coming for dinner. And they had a beautiful apartment in Rome on a rooftop garden. And to make a long story short, there wasn't much to eat. So at one point they put a plate of pasta out on the table, and it started with the two Moroccans, and by the time they finished with it, there was hardly anything left. It was one of those classic dinners, you know. And make a long story short, I heard his wife tell the cook, I don't care what's in the refrigerator, throw it in a pot, eat it up, and put it out on the table. And they did. And it was one of those classic things. But as we were walking from there back to, there was a gentleman from E&I there, very fashionable gentleman, I forget, Vescuzzi his name was. And Vescuzzi was walking us back to our hotel, and I was with, he was with the Brazilian woman who always was upset about something, and I was walking along with Patricia Farley, who was a consultant to ARCO, and she was from the Farley family, who was a great democratic machine in New York. And she said to me, she said, you know, Bob has discussed you with me, and she said, he thinks you're the person in the company who's the most like him. And she said, and someday he'd like to see you become president, which was true. Because I subsequently found out that when Lon Cook was made chairman, he said to Lon, I'd like you to make Hal Cerconi president of Atlantic Richfield. And Cook's answer to that was, I need somebody at this point in time who does what he's told. And Hal has too many ideas of his own, and I just can't do that. So he appointed Bob Wyckoff chairman, and he got exactly what he wanted. And so you know, that was an interesting story, but the point of the whole thing was that at least twice before I left, I was going to leave. And each time it was to do something entrepreneurial, like going ahead and buying those companies from Marco. The previous time it was something that was unrelated to that. It weren't pieces that Arca was selling. I was going to do something else, and I forget what it was at the time. So I had thought about that many times, and I guess I didn't lose a day on old. The reason I called it Freedom Chemical was because I now had the freedom to do what I wanted to do, and freedom from the bureaucracy that was involved at Arca. And the domination of the parent corporation, which really inhibited the development of Arco Chemical. So, that's what I set out to do, and that's what I decided to do. And I formed a partnership with Fred Rullo, who had worked for me at Arco Chemical, but had gone down to Lyondell when we split it off. And left there because he had been promised a lot of things by Lod Cook, and those promises were never fulfilled. So he took a job as president of Combustion Engineering, and the company was merged out of business. And after staying there for a while, he felt he couldn't. He was the president of the boiler division. Combustion Engineering. He felt he couldn't live with that situation, and decided to leave. And he joined me in the Freedom Group partnership. But I knew exactly what I wanted to do when I left, because I had several times come very close to doing it.
And explain. Explain how what it was that you wanted to do and did with Freedom Chemical.
What I wanted to do was to go out and put together a company. And by the way, I never did fulfill all of my objectives there. And I wanted to make it a model company in a standpoint that where the employees were true participants in the company and shareholders and stakeholders, because I've always felt that the basic contract between the employee and the employer has been broken. You know, it used to be that you came to work for a company, you worked there all of your life. Your brother worked there, your sister worked there, your uncle was an employee. That's the way it was, the old Atlantic Refining. That's not true today. You know, as a matter of fact, it's discouraged to have people in the family working, the same family working in the company. Even when people get married who were single when they were at the company, you try to separate them and so forth. But, so I wanted to build a great company and to try some things out from an employee standpoint, employee participation and management of employees, to create an atmosphere where the employees were dedicated to the success of the company. And so we began by buying a product line from American Cyanamid and building it into a company, and then slowly growing, or not so slowly, but growing our company to $300 million and so forth. But ultimately, we were in a position where our shareholders wanted to sell, and I guess I never really got to the point where I wanted to build the kind of environment that I felt you could build and that you could be successful with. So that was the dream, that was the vision, a new company put together, and a company where the people were dedicated to the company and deeply involved and shared in its success. And It's still a dream. I'm working on it a second time now. We'll see if we do better.
What prevented it in that first time round? What was?
Well, what prevented it was that the company wasn't adequately financed, and the shareholders who were leveraged buyout people were more interested in getting their return rather than building and growing a company. And so that's one of the dangers of doing it the way we did it, and you have to be in a position where you can offer them that alternative and still continue to grow the company. We were offered a very good price by B.F. Goodrich, and certainly the management couldn't match that, and so therefore we lost control of the company. I think that's not always true. And, you know, Cambrex is an example where they've gone public and been able to maintain control of the company. Had we gone public, we might have been able to do the same thing.
What is Sargenti Investment Partners doing that's similar and different to how?
Well, what we're doing is very similar from the standpoint that we're trying to build another company, hopefully with a different outcome, where we will this time take it public with the management retaining its share and building on its share to create a company that we can grow and build and do some of the things that we talked about doing. One of the things that we established, you know, going in with these companies, if you notice, of all the companies we bought, we have never gone in and just fired everybody. We try to work with the existing management to imbue in them our philosophy of operations and the way we believe things can be done. And give them an opportunity to move in that direction. Of the six or seven companies that we bought, I think there's only one where we had to replace the management. And that was pretty obvious fairly early that was going to be a problem. But, you know, I delivered a paper at the International Petrochemical Conference a few years ago on building a company through acquisition. And it talks a lot about how we manage and the differences between the way we manage and the way most people manage. And part of the philosophy that I'm discussing, so I won't go into that here, but I'm saying I have written that, and that does contain, you have to ask yourself the question, what makes us think that we can be successful where other people fail? Because the companies we buy are usually not performing well. And but there are a series of beliefs that we have, a series of things that we believe in that we think can make people more productive, more efficient, and more committed to the success of the enterprise.
Who are there role models for this? Heroes? Who's?
Well, there have been a lot of people who not a lot. There have been some people who have been successful. You know, I think Gordon Kane was one of the first to develop the concept of employee sharing in the spoils and so forth, and what you have to do to motivate employees. And so I think Gordon has done an excellent job at that, and his people with his philosophy. There are some others around like that. And then there are the marauders and people who are, you know, in and out as quickly as we can make a buck as well. So, but, you know, I think that if I had to have a model, I think it would be John Huntsman in a way. He's built the company, managed to keep it and maintain control of it turn it into a great family enterprise. I'm not sure.
How many grandchildren have you got?
Well, eventually that may have be a problem for John, because I think they're outgrowing the company. The company's not growing fast enough to assimilate his grandchildren. But I'm not sure what their policies and how they treat their people are. I just don't know. But, you know, there certainly is a great opportunity when you do that.
Do you, has the experience with Freedom influenced your viewers to what other, from the venture capital side, as to who you work with or how you manage that?
Yeah, I think that and it's something I've been dealing with right now. We haven't really talked about the Freedom experience, but and we will at some point. The key here is, if you don't have enough money in today's environment, it's different than when Gordon did it. It's different than when John did it. Gordon Cain and John Hudson. In Gordon's day, in the high-flying 80s, you didn't need very much capital. For instance, I talked about previously Bill Flaherty and his buyout of the ARCO assets. I think he put $2 million up, that was all, and financed the rest on a purchase price of $300 million. Gordon, likewise, I think was able to minimize the amount of money and so forth, borrow the rest. And so you could get by with a lot less equity. If you have to go to the market for equity, then immediately you give up control. Okay. So right now, I am faced with the problem of doing what we did with Freedom, which is getting an equity partner. I already have one in Donaldson, Lufkin, and Generette. But we're moving away from that situation. We're going out and trying to raise a fund of my own from pension funds and so forth. You have to, you know, that almost all of these leveraged buyout firms are funded by well-known pension funds. And they have a very short time horizon, for the most part, and don't really have any interest in building a business that benefits the employees. Most employees, you know, are very critical of companies and so forth. What they don't realize is that what drives all of that is their own pension funds, drive for success and return and so on and so forth. So, and most companies are at least half owned by pension funds. But I'm saying, so the decision is, you go out and raise a fund of your own, in which case you have complete investment discretion and a fair degree of control. But you still won't control when you have to sell, because almost all funds have a 5-year to 7-year time horizon. Or do you get a partner who's already raised funds and work with him and them? And so the two keys are investment discretion and the ability to influence, I won't say control, the disposition of the assets. And I think being able to take the company public is the answer to the management staying in the business and ultimately controlling the company. Okay, and the reason for that is that the reason that doesn't always work, and it didn't work in the case of Freedom, when you go public, the shareholders are not permitted to sell any stock, so you're really going public to raise capital to buy other enterprises. And they're actually restricted from raising, from selling stock. And so you might have to wait 6 months or 12 months before you could sell any stock. And then you'd make some offering, and then you'd have to wait another year to make another offering. So it's a very long process in terms of getting out. And some funds, when they want to get out, they want to get out clean and not have any residual interest. That's not true of them all. For instance, I know Citicorp Venture Capital has had an investment in a chemical company called Cybron. They've been there 10 or more years. They sold out their position, they made their return, and they have a residual interest. So they're not all that way. So it's kind of like a minefield that you have to work your way through to get to the ultimate objective. And starting Freedom, we didn't understand the minefield as well as we should. And although we started down the road of going public, we pulled back to make some additional acquisitions. And then our a lot of time had passed, and our shareholder was nearing the time when he wanted to get out. Been there 5 years, didn't want to take another 2 years, 2.5 years to liquidate his position. And so the decision was made to sell the whole thing. We learned a lot from that.
What can you just talk about the operating experience of Freedom?
Well, it's very different than running a large company, and most people who get involved in this don't understand that. You know, the in a big company, you never worry, usually, how you're going to meet the payroll, how you're going to pay the bills. One of the ways you get very high returns in these leveraged buyouts and so forth is by minimizing the equity. For instance, a leveraged buyout today, where it's much more difficult to finance, the banks would like you to put 25% in. The leveraged buyouts will 25% equity of the total debt. A leveraged buyouts like would like to put 20% in if they can, or even less. And normally, a good company would have 65% equity and 35% debt instead of 20% equity and 80% debt. That changes the entire character of how you have to run the company. You have to focus and concentrate on cash. You can't afford to miss your projections. You have to make sure that your customers pay you on time, and that you collect your receivables efficiently and effectively, that you pay your bills as late as you can, et cetera, et cetera. So the whole thing revolves around cash management. I'll give you an example. In the company we just bought in France, and we bought it in September of 97. And to make a long story short, in December they called up and they said, we're out of money, we're out of cash. We had this big bill to pay for the raw materials. We said, well, you know, you did a 17-week cash forecast and said you were all right. What happened? They said, well, some of the customers didn't pay and so on. We're 2 million francs short. So, well, what do you want from us? We don't have the money. We did, but we weren't going to tell them that. Well, ever since then, they've never missed a cash forecast since. So at Freedom, we had a lot of trouble. Earnings tanked. We had a lot of trouble with needing cash requirements. As a matter of fact, there was a time when FedEx wouldn't deliver to our Cincinnati plant because they paid their bill. There were times when we couldn't release checks for payroll or anything else. We were sitting in the office on Friday afternoon, releasing check by check as we made sure we had enough money to cover them. So it's a completely different orientation, and you spend a lot of time on the financial side, mainly because, to me, they're not properly structured or financed, and that's. But there are instruments now that help that in terms of high yield securities, where you don't pay down the debt, you just pay interest and other things. And I think when you find failures in the leverage buyout area, it's mainly because they haven't been structured and financed properly. And so we learned a lot about that. And just the other day, we were talking with some group venture capitalists about the structure of return of action. And there was a young woman, I think she's just out of Harvard MBA, and she was telling us how it should be structured. And I said to her, well, do you have a lot of experience running a company with that financial structure? And she said, well, that's what we have to do to get our return. I said, that wasn't a question I asked you. I mean, to get your return, we'd like to put no equity in. Then we have an infinite return. And so, I mean, that's the best of all worlds. Let's put $2 in, and then we can all walk away with an infinite return. But we have to run this company. And I'm telling you, you can't run $1.5 billion company with less than 20% equity. It just doesn't happen. And, and that's part of the tension that goes on, I'm saying. Minimize the equity to maximize the return, because they're measured by return, which gives you a great deal of difficulty in financing the company.
So you're basically doing what you were doing with Freedom, but with the benefit of having had a trial run, as it were.
Yeah, I think that's true. And I think we learned a great deal. We learned a great deal about working with funds, about their attitudes, about their needs. And so hopefully we're smart enough to do it better this time and with less turmoil.
Other things in what's happening in the chemical industry in the 1990s that favor or render very difficult what you're trying to do?
Well, I think the environment has become more difficult now, and the reason for that is that we're going through so much consolidation, and consolidation makes very large companies, which don't make effective competitors, in my opinion, from the standpoint that their size may give them an advantage, but what you have is they can also do things which in reality are not very bright. What I'm saying is, you have an $8 or $10 billion competitor, you're a small company, and they have a substantial position in the market. The fact that they're losing money may not impress them, because it's a small wart on the elephant's back. And I used to always say, even when I was at Arco Chemical, we had some of the large German companies as our competitors, and they're like a bunch of trampling elephants. It's a classic example I'll give you. We were in the expandable polystyrene business, and Georgia-Pacific, who was a large customer of BASF and Arco's, had the audacity to go into the business. They licensed technology from Houlz. They built a plant for $50 million. And the response to that, when the plant came on stream, was BASF cut the price in half. Now, we were the largest person with 50% market share. BASF had about 25 or 30. Georgia-Pacific had 10 or 12. We were breaking even, so we knew BASF was losing money. Didn't bother them a bit, because they were, $10 billion. This was a small business over here, so they were losing a few million dollars a year. The point was that Georgia-Pacific shouldn't have come into the business, was their position. Eventually, what happened was I bought out the Georgia-Pacific position. And it was interesting, because we had a very high market share, and people said we couldn't do it. But the business was doing so badly for Georgia-Pacific that we offered them $12 million. And this plant they had spent $45 or $54 million, and they sold it. The reason we offered them $12 million was we didn't have to file a Hart-Scott-Rodino notification, where the cutoff is $15 million. So we made the acquisition. It wasn't a month after we made the acquisition that BASF doubled the prices. Now, all of that was about pride, arrogance, whatever, had nothing to do with the business. So, you know, when I see these huge specialty chemical companies being created, I wonder how much of that's going to happen, and people in the senior management don't even know what's going down at these levels, especially the chemical industry is a bunch of relatively modest and small segments. You know, you can look at a list of it, and there may be 30 or 40 areas, you know, each 50 to 100 million or 150 million, but they're not billion-dollar businesses. There are product lines of a great many different products, specific in their use, but relatively small markets. And you know, so for a smaller company to become very important, when you begin to get $8 or $10 billion companies, I'm not sure how important these markets become, the smaller specialty chemical markets. There are some large ones, of course.
So by being nimble, there's opportunity.
You have to be nimble, but I'm saying it's more difficult today than it was a few years ago, and I worry about that, as to whether the concept that I have can really be effective in today's environment. It's a very good question that you asked, Arnold, because I'm saying, with Freedom, a $500 or $600 million company was a good size, especially chemical company. In today's environment, you have to have much higher aspirations than that, because you got the Morton Roman Haas merger, the Clariant merger, on and on it goes. These huge, huge companies that are being created. However, I've never been a fan of size, and I think size breeds bureaucracy and inefficiency in the management. You may get some consolidation savings and other things, but being big is no guaranteed formula for success.
How many other people, if any, do you know who are trying to do what you're trying to do?
Yeah, there was a recent article that was being written about this. Chemical Week called me about it, and you know, there was George Harris has done this and has been extremely successful in what he did. There are a number of other people getting started and trying as a group. A couple of Exxon guys out of Cleveland, that they call it the Geo Group, I think. And there are a few around. Most are out trying to do big commodity chemical deals, and we look at those too. But in most cases, the bigger the deal, the more competition there is from people in the business and strategic buyers, and a financial buyer can never outbid a strategic buyer. That's the problem. But there are a number around, Arnold. I can't tell you, I can't give you the names, but everybody who leaves a major corporation and a senior executive wants to go out and try to do this.
Thinks about it.
Well, they think about it, but usually after a year or two of trying, they give up.
Yes. Yes.
It's not easy work, and it's difficult, and you know, it's not easy. So, from that standpoint,
is there any geographic advantage in? I mean, is there an ideal place in the world or the United States to be if you were doing this?
Well, I think today Europe is as good a place as any. And we just lost a major transaction in Europe, and we have one company in Europe. The restructuring that's going on in Europe creates these spin-offs. In the United States, there's greater selectivity. So I'd say it's easier to do what we're doing in Europe than it is in the United States today. But it's always here. One of the things that people don't realize is that there are literally thousands of companies
that are privately owned in the chemical industry. And there are opportunities for consolidation. So from that standpoint, so everybody knows the DuPonts of the world and the Dows, but there are literally thousands in Philadelphia here. You know, if you went through a list of companies, there'd probably be 10 or 15 chemical companies, most of them people never heard of.
Yes.
And you know, so those are the companies that we look for. If you look at this paper I talked about before, I give the characteristics of the companies that we bought, most of them were privately held or failed auctions, that kind of thing. So.
Just one last question, then a time check, Hal. The last question is, what's in this territory is, what are the essential ingredients to enable you to keep working in this territory? What is it that you need to?
What is unique?
What is it that you need? I mean, besides the access to dollars, but what does it take to do this?
Well, you have to be able to. I think the single most. Once you get the access to dollars, and there are a lot of dollars out there, the question is, getting the access to getting a partner who's interested in growing the business, understands their ups and downs, and has the patience to see it through to completion. So that's all very important, and allows a certain investment discretion. In other words, if you're going to work with a partner who, when you bring ideas to them, they go out and hire A.D. Little and consultants and so forth to come in and evaluate what you told them, you just wind up spinning your wheels. The financial backer that you have has to say, I'm satisfied that this is a group of executives, a team of people who know what they're doing, and I'm going to move forward with them in a expeditious way. So the proper backer is one thing. The second thing is being able to ferret out and see deals. Because if you go into auctions, they're very difficult to be successful in. And as a matter of fact, you really can't be successful because you wind up paying too much. So you have to be able to find deals in yourself. What we like are failed auctions, where the expectations of the seller have not been met in the auction process, or there's some specific problem. So we look for deals where there are failed auctions, problems, environmental problems, where they've been unable to negotiate a successful agreement, or other problems in the business that we feel we can solve. So the generation of deals that you can buy at a price that's appropriate for a financial buyer is a very important characteristic to be successful. A lot of people can't generate those deals. I might say it gets more and more difficult to generate them as your contacts become fewer and fewer. So you can't be out of this business forever and continue this. You have to bring in fresh people with fresh ideas and contacts. I've been blessed by the fact that I achieved a very high rank as president of a company when I was very young, in my 40s. You know, I've told you I've seen 5, 6, 7 chairmen of DuPont in the time I've been around. And so I still have some contacts and whatnot, but you have to have appropriate contacts in the industry. You have to be able to ferret out deals that can be accomplished and financed, and you need a strong supporting partner financially. And those are the keys, but the deals are not easy to find. And we work, for instance, on deals. Sometimes a year or more will go by. For instance, a company we just lost because of our own inefficiency was the Holtermann Company, a big German contract manufacturing company, where the first contacts with that company were in 1996,
It was 1998, August, before they decided to sell, and where we were able to get a position that gave us a dominant position, and then we blew it. Our partners really weren't equipped to move forward with it. And we lost it to an English company that came in and paid $10 million more for it. But I use that as an example of beginning the conversations, ferreting out the transactions. And we do that all the time. We talk to people, we make suggestions. There are a number of companies that I've talked to, none of them want to sell the first time you go in. And, you know, but we keep contact, we keep going back. And eventually something happens that triggers the fact that they're going to sell. If they're private companies, it's usually estate problems. For instance, to give you an example, a company in Germany, the founding family were the owners of 100 years in the family, two 80-year-old sisters and an 84-year-old chairman of the company. Sisters saying, hey, we're not going to live forever. We have to get the estate settled. The chairman, a reluctant seller, but recognizing that the sisters are correct, agrees to sell the company. That happens a lot. Other things that happen is that the family suddenly realizes that they're being asked to put a lot of money in for environmental things and other things, and the business is getting very capital intensive and very expensive to own. And so they decide we better get out and cut our losses and not tie up any more capital in the business. So you've got to constantly have a number of deals that you're proposing. And then they come to fruition for a lot of different reasons.
Sounds like fundraising.
It is a little bit. You know, another one is you call on a company and you, for instance, I'm working on one of these now where the business we want to buy is a $100 million business and a $4 billion company. It has absolutely no fit with the company whatsoever. Did it one time many years ago, and sooner or later they will sell that business. The idea is to buy it before they auction it. So we're working with them. So, so maybe that's a good point to stop.
I think we're about 2/3 of the way through the territory in fact.
So we
obviously should schedule
another
session.
Right.
But thank you for that.
I didn't realize I could talk that.